For a time, Marilyn Waring was seen as one of the brightest stars of the National Party. Elected to Parliament in 1975 at the age of 23, she was then the youngest MP New Zealand had had. The then Prime Minister, Rob Muldoon, had been heard to publicly praise her intellect and abilities. She was elected Chair of the Public Expenditure Committee. But as time went by, Marilyn Waring seemed to move away from the party and the national government, culminating in her announced intention to cross the floor and vote against it on the issue of nuclear ship visits. Sir Robert Muldoon called a snap election. The rest is history. Since then, Marilyn Waring, goat farmer, listener columnist, economist, and for her, most importantly, feminist, has been writing a book about what men value and what women are worth. She joins us in the studio now. Good morning.
It's good morning, Jeff.
Counting for Nothing, the name of the book, because we can't measure it or because we're scared to measure it?
Because it was simply decided by the gentlemen statisticians and economists who drew up the system of national accounts that housework didn't count, that it wasn't productive. And since it's nowhere defined, it effectively becomes a residual category for everything that women do in an unpaid capacity. And, of course, children and their work are omitted. The work of the elderly is omitted. In spite of the fact that the rules say that you can impute values for any work that is unpaid if it has a market equivalent, it simply doesn't happen. And so the productive contributions of the majority of the human species are absent from the national accounting systems of every country in the world.
At the time they were drawn up, were they reasonable?
Well, I guess the first major or effective recognition was for a very specific purpose. In 1939, John Maynard Keynes and Sir Richard Stone wrote a publication called The British National Income and How to Pay for the War. And in fact, what they wanted to introduce was a concept that said to Parliament, yes, you can mobilise and deficit budget and you can still afford to pay for it. This works by proving through this mechanism, for example, that if silk is made into parachutes instead of silk stockings, you get more productivity. It's a very perverse system, and the major principles and rules have not changed to this day.
But at the time, it must have been necessary to do that. I mean, if they hadn't done that, presumably there was a chance that the war wouldn't have been fought. We might not have been sitting here talking today.
Well, one of the problems, of course, of that is that after the British won the war, the system of national accounts began to be attributed with part of the reason that had happened. And so the system began to be imposed on everybody. I don't think that it follows at all, frankly.
So it's a mythology that we built on.
It certainly is, and it's one that now condemns us all to a system that values war, that values poisoning, that values the destruction of cities, that values death.
It's very hard, I think, for the individual to see how they fit in to the big national figures, gross national product, gross domestic product, and all that sort of thing, for me to relate what I'm doing now to that.
Well, for you, it's not so bad. Oh, because at least you paid, you're in the market, you're visible to the policy planners. People think of you as a producer. The system describes the large majority of women who are not in the paid workforce as economically inactive, as unoccupied, and as unproductive. And so you've got a classic alienation there straight away. It's no wonder that women think that economics is a mystery or that they don't understand it. If a system treats you like that, you're going to set off on the wrong foot right from the start.
Now, you've written a book which explains all these things, and so women can read it and say, hey, I now understand where I am. But surely the next step is the important one. What do we do about it? How do we change?
Well, I've tried to do a number of things. The book tries to demystify the system of national accounts for people. Therefore, it tries to impart information, and information is power. You then empower people to do something about their lives. I've also, in the book, worked through all the alternative strategies that at one time or another I thought might have been possible. But the more that you think about simply trying to give a price to everything in the system, the more anathema that becomes. Fresh air, fresh water, amazing environments, these things don't have a price. Of course, air has a price through an air conditioner, and water has a price if you have to buy it. and Forrest, Tony have a prize if you knock them down. I mean, these are problems. And the conservation, preservation, the interaction of our ecosystem can't be treated like that. And I was also wary of course, writing a book that was entirely negative. And so I hope in the last at least three chapters, what I've begun to do is to develop a completely alternative scenario for judgment by policymakers and for government administration for the well-being of the people. And in one sense, I suppose, in doing this, I'm lucky. People can't tell me it won't work. I've been there. I know it will work.
How do you put a value on those other things? I mean, do you have to put a value
on
environment in the monetary
terms? No, you don't have
to put
price. No, at all. In fact, what I would perceive is that you have effectively two sets of indicators. None of them are price indicators. One is a qualitative environmental situation, a kind of environmental accounting, so that every year you can tell, you know, what's happened to your water quality levels, your air quality levels, things like habitat and housing and nutrition, they all fit into this as well. And the other alternative which I've suggested is that if you stand back from people's lives and say, well, what do they have in common? If it, you know, if we're going to omit this word price, how do they spend their hours? Well, they certainly spend them in exchange. But the largest number of hours that they spend in exchange is in the altruistic economy. And the second largest number of hours they spend is in interaction, in exchange with the government. And the smallest market of all is what the one that currently conditions all our lives. I argue, perhaps as a throwaway line, but I'm quite serious about it, that if the market says that it needs these indicators, the market can pay for it. And that will release the resources to determine the needs and the well-being of the majority of the community who don't operate in the price market, but who do operate in altruistic exchange. And those two sets of figures would then make it possible for you to direct your policy planning towards needs. Childcare, for example, becomes a working condition for people who work 16, 17 more hours a day, 7 days a week, with a multiplicity of skills, a huge variety of demands, who are exhausted and extremely tired and need support structures. Things like petrol rebates for people who drive Meals on Wheels becomes, you know, perfectly obvious kind of policy option. The kinds of investment decisions that have been made in agriculture finally become sensible because you're not basing them on a per capita productivity that only concerned the person who was receiving some payment on the farm. I mean, most New Zealand farms certainly aren't one per capita production, although that's how the Census of Agriculture records them. They've got 2 point, or at least three, you know, mum works, the children work, everybody who's there at the moment in the rural situation is working. Mm. And so we're grossly underestimating the kinds of support structures that are needed in the rural area. If you make your whole population visible, then as a government, you can deliver to them what they need, and that's your job as a government. Given the current system, you haven't got a chance.
Talking about the current system, the end of your book, you quote a woman called Elizabeth Reed at the UN Conference for Women in Mexico City, and she says, women are working for change. The only possible weapons to hand for us are proven ability and persuasion. We must become skilled in negotiating, lobbying, the preparation of resolutions, documents, legislation, and so on. We must gain an extensive understanding of the workings of the system, be well briefed, well appointed, visible. She goes on, you've got to be within the system in order to change it. Do you accept that?
I think we have to be everywhere, and I just have funny feelings about definitions like that. I mean, patriarchy is everywhere. I mean, that's a system. And we just have to be everywhere that it is. I think that we have to begin to have also remember that we want to celebrate the kinds of changes that we're making, because the world that we're looking for is one that values and respects life and nurturance and caring, these kinds of things, so that the kinds of tactics which we want to develop to change the world, give us a lot of fun. I've suggested a very, you know, simple one in the book of really enjoying filling in the census, of refusing to, you know, go to the bottom to to not complete the questionnaire because it says housework is admitted, so that when they ask you what you do, you say, well, look, I'm a chef, I'm a gardener, I'm a nutrition expert and a childcare expert and a chauffeur and,
you know,
to everything. And I work 116 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, you know. Make yourself visible. Enjoy it.
I can hear one of our listeners who's going to ring me after this interview, I'm sure, an elderly gentleman. He's going to grumble about saying, why do you publicise people like her trying to upset the established order of things? He listens to you, but he doesn't hear what you're saying. How do you get messages through to those people?
Well, in a sense, I'm actually not even worried whether or not I do. Women are the majority of the human species, and they're disempowered at the moment, largely through lack of information. This book is based on lives of women all around the world that has been shared with me from the positions of enormous privileged access that I've had. I mean, I didn't dream these things. And what I'm saying to women is, listen, when you've felt that things haven't been right and you've thought maybe you were going crazy or didn't understand the system, it's not you. You're quite right. You should be paranoid. This is one of the most evil, perverted forms of systems that we have in our lives. It equates value with price. That is not what we value on this planet. And if we are to be at the forefront of valuation on the planet and of preserving this planet, then the kinds of things that we find worthy must become the primary considerations.
Marilyn Waring, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Marilyn Waring, author of a new book called Counting for Nothing, What Men Value and What Women Are Worth.